I have enjoyed speaking with Patrick O'Donnell about a number of the books that he has written, and I'm very excited indeed to be talking with him today about his latest book, which in many ways is a crowning achievement on his impressive career. The book is titled The Unvanquished, The Untold Story of Lincoln's Special Forces, The Manhunt for Mosby's Rangers, and The Shadow War That Forged America's Special Operations. One theme which we find in many of Mr. O'Donnell's books is this notion of special forces, of sort of alternative ways of waging war. And in some respects, this book draws our attention to one of the most important moments in the history of the development of this kind of warfare during our own Civil War. And it draws upon important stories from both sides of that awful conflict. And in many ways, we come away from it with a profoundly new understanding about what special forces are all about and the extraordinary difference that they can make. This book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press, again titled The Unvanquished, The Untold Story of Lincoln's Special Forces, The Manhunt for Mosby's Rangers, and The Shadow War That Forged America's Special Operations. Patrick O'Donnell, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
It's an honor to be with you, Greg, and thank you for that beautiful introduction.
I have really enjoyed this book. I have learned so much from it, and that's always the case with the books that you write and bring to the public. If I remember correctly, one of the primary inspirations for you to explore this largely untold, largely obscure story centers around a couple of road signs that you encountered. Tell our listeners about this and, in a sense, the fascinating long odyssey on which you were sent, in a sense.
Greg, I've been writing for 25 years full-time, and as you mentioned, 13 books. And all of those books have found me in one way or another. And what I mean by that is the classic case being The Unvanquished. I was driving around Northern Virginia, and I found, I always checked the roadside signs because there's usually some incredible things that are just, it's history in plain sight. And that was clearly the case with the first sign that I found, which was the story of Jack Sterry, a Jesse scout who tried to alter the course of the Second Battle of Manassas through his deception and actions. It's, you know, the battle is raging, and Jack is dressed as a Confederate in a Confederate uniform. He's a Union scout dressed as a Confederate, and he is trying to lead General Hood down the wrong road. He's insisting that he had received orders from General Jackson that Hood's force of thousands of men were needed in Middleburg, where they were regrouping from the battle. It was a complete falsehood. And had he succeeded, he may have altered the course of the war and certainly the battle. But there were certain things about Jack's story that just, they seemed so authentic. But for 45 minutes, he held up a major wing of the Confederate Army as he went back and forth trying to explain to them why they needed to go to Middleburg. And they unmask him eventually and realize that this is a fraud that is trying to deceive them. And the sign marks the last moments of Jack Sterry's life. It represents the hanging tree that the Confederates, after they unmasked him, they hung him as a spy, and he was killed. The story is remarkable in the sense that his body was found in the 1960s when they widened the road, along with a Confederate courier that he had killed literally hours earlier. Both bodies were recovered. And Sterry's story is remarkable because he's a man that's in the right time at the right place and tries to influence things. This book is about the Jesse Scouts, or Lincoln Special Forces. It's an untold story of men like Jack Sterry that through their actions and daring try to change the course of war, and they do. And many of these men like Jack never come home. They receive, they earn 7 medals of honor, but most of these men die during the war, and that's one of the reasons why it's an untold story.
Right. So just to clarify, what exactly was this that you came upon, and to what extent was it opening your eyes to a story that you knew nothing about? Or at that point, did you know at least a little something about this amazing story of this young man and his bravery?
It was the second sign that I found. And within that sign, it referenced John Singleton Mosby, this great partisan leader that the Confederates had. And he basically he pioneers modern guerrilla warfare from an American perspective through his actions. He's this incredible leader that's only 5'7", 128 pounds, you know, dripping wet, but just has an incredible way about him. And he is absolutely ruthless, but at the same time treats prisoners properly. He's just an enigma, a mystery in many ways. But I had found a sign that referenced him along this journey also. It was called the Grapewood Farm Engagement. And I just looked at him like, what the heck is the Grapewood Farm Engagement? Went off to the side of the road, and it was here that Mosby and his men had trained a mountain howitzer on Union cavalry that had been pursuing them after they had disabled a train using a mountain howitzer. And they looted the train, and you know, they were in the middle of a Union cavalry camp, and they were in hot pursuit of Mosby's Rangers, and it was at the Grapewood Farm that they had set up an ambush. But it was a deadly affair. Many of Mosby's men would die, including a foreigner observer by the name of Hopkins, who fought in the Crimean War with the British. And I found his grave, which was nearby as well. So it was an unraveling of all these threads that led me to the Unvanquished. And it's an extraordinary story with the Jesse Scouts is the through line in who they interact with, who they hunt, includes John Singleton Mosby and the Confederate Secret Service.
Mm. I want to circle back to an entirely different matter that helps us understand, in a sense, the significance of this story beyond sort of its immediate importance. That is, what happened during our own American Civil War. Rather surprisingly, when we open up your book, one of the first things that we read is something that references the Second World War. The start of the preface is talking about events in 1941. Explain why this is right at the outset of your book and what the connection is between some of the dramatic events of the Second World War and the story that you tell in The Unvanquished.
In 1941, America did not possess special operations forces. Kind of like a sine curve, Greg. America has a rich history of irregular warfare and special operations dating back before the American Revolution in the French and Indian War. But, you know, tragically, the U.S. Army and its other elements we're not learning organizations, so to speak, from that time period. So much of the it was lost. And then there was also bureaucratic issues where people viewed special operations or even spycraft as something that was ungentlemanly. This had languished. It had been, there were no special operations in 1941. But meanwhile, the Axis powers were using them to their great advantage. And it was the Office of Strategic Services, it was actually called the Coordinator of Information at that time, that was run by Colonel Wild Bill Donovan, later General Donovan. And General Donovan was a visionary, and he is, in many ways, the true father of American Special Operations Forces. he, you know, realizes that he's in a race against time. In order for him to compete against Germany and Japan, they need to have a regular warfare and special operations forces, as well as a national intelligence agency that kind of looks at and combines those things together. They didn't have anything. So what they did is Donovan took on his staff were some of the greatest historians in U.S. history that were part of the research and analysis branch. He had his scholars look into what worked in the past. It was his idea to look at the Civil War, our first modern war. And in the Civil War, they looked at specifically the units that I wrote about, the Jesse Scouts, the Confederate Secret Service, and John Singleton Mosby, because of the success that these men had during the war, but also the trade craft that they had pioneered. And this is the untold story of what they looked at. And what occurred during the Civil War is extraordinary.
Hmm. And of course, what you're saying is it prompted then the United States to, in effect, play catch-up when it came to special forces, and that was at least one of the factors that contributed significantly to the Allies ultimately winning the Second World War, this reclaiming of our own history.
My favorite quote in there is Donovan saying that in order for him to catch up, he literally needs to kill the umpire and steal the ball from the Axis in order for his amateurs, these civilians that are drawn from all walks of American life, they're drawn from the military, they're drawn from civilian life, and they form operational groups, Jedburgh teams, but their inspiration is the Civil War, and they learn much of the tradecraft. The book is not about what those forces with Donovan created, but what inspired them. And this is the story of the Jesse Scouts.
This, for those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Patrick K. O'Donnell about his latest book, which is called The Unvanquished, The Untold Story of Lincoln's Special Forces, The Manhunt for Mosby's Rangers, and The Shadow War That Forged America's Special Operations. I wonder if you could just spend a moment explaining to our listeners that intriguing term in the subtitle, Shadow War. We see it used a lot. We also see it utilized in different ways. Explain what you are talking about in terms of a so-called shadow war, and then specifically what we're talking about in terms of the shadow war that was fought amidst the Civil War as it was perceived sort of in the foreground of history.
Covert operations and special operations, Greg, are influencing our lives to this day. One only has to look towards the Middle East, to Taiwan, in different places where these operations, covert operations, are influencing and impacting our lives. And this book, The Shadow War and the Civil War, is what you sort of think of as some of the obvious things, like going after wagon trains, for instance, or ambushing a train that's on a track. It was also about tying down large numbers of Union forces that had to go after these guerrilla fighters. But it's way more sophisticated than that, and I think that's what the book really provides a unique look at the Civil War. The South was in a really disadvantage in terms of manpower. But what we do know, even today, the 21st and 20th century, that insurgencies are almost impossible to stop if they have the support of the civilian population. Within that, though, are covert operations that take place. And the Confederate Secret Service was 100 years ahead of its time in many ways. They were directly trying to interfere with the election of 1864 and influence it. And that influence is remarkable and striking. One aspect that they looked at was that they saw that the northern population was completely fatigued by the war. In 1864, certainly at the beginning of the war and then midway through the war, nothing seemed to be working at all for the Union. There were massive casualties. The Union had 280,000 desertions, if you look at it from the perspective of the entire war. It was incredibly unpopular. It was called a forever war. And one of the things that the Confederacy did that was really novel at the time was that they specifically tried to influence the press. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is, the democracy controls the press. And in many ways, it did. Most of the newspapers were controlled by Democrat Party members that were editors, and they were anti-war, anti-Lincoln. And they plied them with gold to write stories that were, you know, to erode Northern morale. Within that, though, they also tried to influence the election by specifically buying the rising aspect of Lincoln's opposition, which was the Copperhead movement within the Democratic Party, which is the most powerful movement within the party. And it's an extraordinary story. The main leader of that party was a Confederate, was basically bought off by the Confederate Secret Service. And they write the campaign platform for 1864, which is a campaign platform of peace. It's an armistice to end the war and through negotiations. And they realize that if you have an armistice, it's extremely difficult to start the war back up. And this is, they're extremely successful in their operations to do this. And it goes from there. There are covert operations to burn New York City to the ground. There's, operations to go after high-level leaders, including the President of the United States. It's exceptional stuff that most people don't realize, that in 1864, the election was going the wrong way for Abraham Lincoln. And he was absolutely convinced that another special operation that took place, which was the Jubal Early Raid in the summer of 1864, were nearly, a Confederate army of over 12,000 men almost took over Washington, D.C., and also raided there were POW camps at Point Lookout, for instance, which had over 10,000 Confederate prisoners. Had they been jailbroken, they may have joined the Confederate Army. All these things kind of combined. What you see is that the South is turning towards irregular warfare and covert operations to change the course, and they nearly do.
Right. At one point you say, in talking about Mosby's Rangers, they were pioneering ingenious ways of disrupting conventional approaches to military victory. And another point that you make in your book is that this was, in a sense, not just about trying to secure what we might think of as a conventional victory, the South over the North, because for as much as the tide of the war was very more evenly balanced than we might realize, there were some ways in which the South was never going to be able to conquer the North, in a sense. But you point out that central to the Southern strategy was denying the Union a clear victory. And that might be enough to ultimately secure that armistice and preserve the Confederacy. And of course, one gets a sense from your book, The Unvanquished, how the activity of these special forces could be absolutely crucial in terms of denying the Union a clear and emphatic victory.
Greg, what most people now know, if you look at the history of the 20th century, insurgencies are almost impossible to defeat because they don't have to win. They just need to survive. And that is something that is a clear problem and very, very difficult if you have the large or vast majority of the population that basically supports the insurgency. And what most people don't realize is even in 1864 and 1865, the Union Army had only occupied a very, very tiny portion of the South, which was a vast place to occupy. There were never enough troops to do it. It was the same. It's a problem with many counterinsurgency issues. You know, thank God we had men like the Jesse Scouts that literally will change the course of the war through their actions.
We're speaking with Patrick K. O'Donnell about his latest book, The Unvanquished, The Untold Story of Lincoln's Special Forces, The Manhunt for Mosby's Rangers, and The Shadow War That Forged America's Special Operations. So it is a very important decision that is made, I believe, as early as 1862, for the Confederacy to embrace in a very significant way this notion of irregular warfare by special forces, which ultimately will be led by this John Singleton Mosby, as you've already said, a rather unlikely leader, kind of a bookworm lawyer, but who ends up being quite effective. Explain what the genesis of this was. That is, whose idea exactly was it to launch special forces on the Confederate side?
It comes even earlier than that. What you have is areas of the country that are very much insurgent friendly, if you will. For instance, Missouri is raging with brother against brother, neighbor against neighbor. West Virginia is also a hotbed of insurgency where people are just intertwined. It's not clear lines where you have, for instance, Georgia versus Maine. It's a situation where there's so much of the population is on either side. It's in West Virginia in particular where a lot of this activity really kind of bubbles up. And the Confederacy authorizes the use of a partisan act where they allow guerrillas to fight an irregular campaign against Union forces, but they're also kind of under the auspices of the Confederate Army. And this thing kind of morphs and expands from there. And you have this sort of conventional guerrilla warfare, but also you have at its head the Secret Service of the Confederacy. And this is another incredible untold story of the war, because they burned most of their files at the end of the war. But they're extraordinary. They have to innovate in order to overcome the massive advantages that the Union has in terms of supplies, in terms of men and money. And they look at an asymmetric war to do that. And it's multifaceted. There, you've got an entire department that is kind of like Q's lab in James Bond, where they're developing specialized time bombs, for instance, or torpedoes, as they called them, which were landmines. But also, you know, these were fitted on the submarine, the Hunley, for instance. And there's all these really wild gadgets, such as a coal bomb, which was a, you know, piece of coal that was hollowed out that included explosives, so it could be tossed into the pile of, you know, on a steamship. And it would look like just a regular piece of coal, but once it went into the boiler of the steamship, it would blow it sky high. And the Secret Service had a number of operations that were very successful with some of their technology. But then they also had agents. They had a signal corps, which was crucial in order for them to communicate with other aspects of the Army and also deliver and transmit covert messages. It's a fascinating story of men and women. And one of my favorite characters in this book is the French woman. And the French woman is a woman that is, you know, her husband goes to war, but she's tired of sitting around. And she decides that she wants a life of adventure. She speaks perfect French. So they realize that she'd be perfect for her role as a courier, and specifically, the Confederacy sets up operations in Canada at the time, in Montreal in particular, and she goes back and forth as a courier, and her name is, she's mysterious, but she gets the nickname of the French woman because she speaks French, always wearing a veil, always kind of moving in and out of circles, very shadowy. And even at the end of the war, she is hunted by the entire Union intelligence establishment, but just mysteriously disappears.
Before we talk about how the Union side responds with its own special forces, I want to talk for a moment about the relationship that these kind of special forces typically have with the more conventional military hierarchy. And of course, I'm asking especially about this particular time frame, that is the American Civil War. And, you know, what would typical military leaders engaged in more standard warfare, what would their attitude typically be about this notion of special forces? To what extent would they welcome it? To what extent would at least some of them be highly resistant to the notion? To what extent would some of them even be insulted by the thought that that they and their mighty forces require the assistance of these sort of shadowy, mysterious figures engaging in guerrilla warfare? I mean, what was the relationship, and particularly from military leaders and maybe even from standard soldiers, how would they have regarded this kind of activity?
What you see is sort of a push and pull between those that believed in conventional operations and those that looked at these irregular operations as a possibility. But in by and large, the conventional brass, if you will, hated this stuff. This is something that you will see in American history throughout history, all the way up until the 1950s. It was looked upon that these were taking good men away from the conventional forces that could really fight and win the war. It was bleeding these great, you know, otherwise extraordinary figures into this sort of shadowy realm. And then within that, you also had honor. And this honor kind of extends on both sides, in the Union and in the South, where this is looked at as despicable and sort of ungentlemanly in many ways. And Robert E. Lee is probably the one figure that is very much torn between, you know, he realizes that he has a major problem on his hands, and that he really conventionally would be very, very difficult to somehow even survive. So he looks upon these shadow operations as a potential way to influence and impact the election of 1864 and, you know, somehow secure more favorable terms for the South. But in that realm, he's always just torn between honor and, you know, potentially winning. And then there's also the fact that some of these shadow operations are not, they're not honorable in many ways, because you're doing assassination, or you're, for instance, they're trying to burn down New York City, and they're almost successful. Or there was even a plot to release the plague on northern population. I mean, this is pretty sophisticated stuff that we're dealing with today in many ways. But that is a tug and pull that's constant in the book. And it's through that that friction that these men are able to pioneer some amazing things.
And we certainly hear about some intriguing moments in the conflict. For instance, why don't you tell our listeners about what unfolds, I think it's in 1862, at something called Miskell Farms?
Yeah, this is what's beautiful about the Unvanquished is much of the area that John Singleton Mosby and the Union Jesse Scouts or Lincoln Special Forces operated in Loudoun County, still is there. Loudoun County in particular, Prince William County, parts of it, it's almost like it's a time capsule where you can go back in time. In the book, The Unvanquished is sort of a travel guide. You can literally go out and visit the sign of the Greatwood Farm engagement, or the Jesse Scout of Jack Sterry story at the Plains that I mentioned. But at Miskell Farm, it's the very beginning of Mosby's Rangers. Mosby, as I mentioned, is this bookish kind of lawyer that is, you know, a young guy, very 5'7". He never drinks anything. He only drinks coffee. He has an addiction, as one of his men say, to the bean, and he only likes the real thing. But he asked Jeb Stuart, who's his immediate superior in the winter of 1862, that he'd like to start this partisan force. And he says, sure, you can have six men, including a guy that has a club foot, and go at it. And Mosby, it's remarkable, in January and February, he grows this tiny force into nearly 100 men. And one of his greatest accomplishments is going into, behind the lines, into Fairfax, Virginia, Fairfax Courthouse, and literally kidnaps a Union general in front of, you know, thousands, or, you know, he's able to infiltrate and exfiltrate this Union general from thousands of Union cavalrymen. And that sort of raises his status. And it's at Miskell Farm only weeks later that they're on a patrol, and they decide to water their horses. And it's near the Potomac River. It's deeper in Loudoun County, not too far from Sterling, Virginia. And it's here that they bed down for the night. And it's in sort of a cul-de-sac where the only way out is through the front gate. And Union cavalry has intelligence that the Rangers are in this encampment. And they plan to surprise them in the morning with, you know, twice their numbers at least. And it's at Miskell Farm that Mosby and his men do what they always do, which is they attack immediately. It's the swiftness and boldness and really the severity of their attacks. They're shock attacks, and they use not sabers, but the pistol. And it's Colt navies and Colt armies that they have, and a few Remingtons. And they are immediately on horseback. Much of this book is these dramatic stories on horseback. They literally fight their way out of Miskell Farm. And they subdue a force that's twice their size. And one of the men that's wounded is the leader of this Union cavalry unit. He's very severely wounded. But it's here that you sort of see an interesting side of Mosby. He literally takes care of that man. He makes sure that his men take him to a house that he can recover from, you know, his wounds, which are grievous. And it's like much of the story, there's an underlying story of humanity here that you don't really think about during the Civil War. This man recovers from his wounds. He then becomes a governor of a major state. And then Mosby, they've remained friends after the war. And it's fascinating that within this violence, there is a streak of humanity that takes place.
It is interesting. I mean, it is surprising that many of the people engaging in this seem to operate within a certain code of conduct that we might not necessarily expect. And certainly there are plenty of examples from other time periods and other conflicts where these kind of special operations are carried out in far more, in a sense, brutal and inhumane fashion. But that is at least largely not the case here. Well, let's talk about the other side of the conflict, namely the Jesse Scouts, as they were known, that were a very significant part of the Union's effort to enter the fray of special forces and unconventional military operations. First of all, right at the outset, explain the interesting story behind the name, the Jesse Scouts. Explain the woman whom they were named after.
This is a story, the name is from a powerful woman. And the origin of the Jesse Scouts comes from John Fremont, the first Republican candidate. in the 1850s for the Republican Party, U.S. Senator, but he was also known as the Pathfinder, and he was a great explorer, and Fremont utilized scouts to great effect during his explorations. And it's in 1861 where he is a general officer, and he realizes that he needs excellent scouts, and he brings together a small group of men that are extraordinary in many ways. They have experience in the West, which is a very brutal place at the time, either exploring or scouting, but also battling Native Americans, and they bring their tradecraft to this small group of men. And they are in admiration of General Fremont's wife, Jessie. And as one contemporary said, Jesse was the better man of the two, being even better than General Fremont. She was an extraordinary woman, well-educated. She had an incredible charisma. She was just powerful. And she, in many ways, would fight battles for General Fremont in Washington, D.C. Her father was a powerful senator. She just had this incredible charisma, and the men looked up to her, and they named the unit the Jesse Scouts from her. And this is where it's got kind of a Hollywood feel to it that's just interesting. The Scouts do some amazing things. They are able to infiltrate, for instance, Fort Donelson, which is under the control of the Confederacy. One of the men is so good, he gets in and out. He draws a map of Fort Donelson. In one scene, he literally escapes using the guise of a woman. Most of the time, these men are dressed as Confederates, even though they are Union soldiers or scouts. But the scouts have sort of a checkered past that doesn't bode well for the Army. It doesn't really bode well for anyone, because if the stuff isn't nailed down, they're stealing it. And their reputation just plummets as they do. They steal things. They sort of conduct different little scams. It's mainly the leader of the Scouts, a guy by the name of John Carpenter, who's a captain that is, conducting this many of these things. And what happens is he's literally cashiered out of the Army. General Fremont leaves the Army, and the Scouts languished. Most of the men are dispersed, and we think that it could have been the end of them, but no. A small remnant of these extraordinary individuals survives, and they're passed along from one command to another. General Averill, for instance, picks them up and utilizes them to great effect, where they're conducting raids in and around West Virginia. And it's here that they conduct some of the great raids on the railroads in and around that area. And these raids are, they can break a man. I mean, it's in mountainous territory in the wintertime, where these men have to literally march or ride on horses hundreds of miles in the most rugged terrain of the United States to destroy railroads as the Confederacy are hunting them in the process. And it's the Scouts that are out front to lead Averill's armies. And they're armed with pistols, and in some cases, sort of the machine gun of the Civil War, which is the Spencer repeating rifle. And they provide battlefield reconnaissance and also capture incredibly important targets like bridges, for instance. The fact that they're in Confederate uniform allows them to infiltrate through the lines and secure high-value prisoners or targets. And they are then passed upon along to General Philip Sheridan, who utilizes them as a strategic force to really lead the armies, and his army in particular. And his army will go on to actually help win the Civil War.
And yes, that the role that they play, in a sense, becomes even more central. We're beginning to run out of time, but I want to give you a moment to talk about someone I'm pretty sure we have not even mentioned, or if we have, only very briefly, on the Union side, one Richard Blazer. Just in a minute or two, summarize his significance in this story?
Richard Blazer is one of my favorite characters, and he is a Confederate manhunter. His role is to hunt Confederate soldiers, specifically guerrillas. But Richard Blazer is not only a man on the mission, but he's got one eye that kind of wanders. He's not his uniform is always sloppy. His buttons aren't buttoned. He's a total flop on the parade ground. But this guy is an incredible, he gathers intelligence at the smallest sources. He talks to anyone. I mean, enslaved individuals, civilians, to build kind of a mosaic of information on where these guerrillas are hiding. And it's Blazer that hunts first partisans or guerrillas that are in West Virginia to great effect. And that's in many ways kind of a JV team compared to Mosby. And the men are then equipped by Philip Sheridan to go after John Singleton Mosby. They also also lead the armies as well. They do this tactical intelligence, and an element of this group also dresses in Confederate uniform and to infiltrate behind Southern lines. Just an extraordinary individual.
I want to say that your book recounts many of these crucial moments in the war in really amazing detail, and it's incredible that we have so much information about this so-called shadow war fought so long ago during our own Civil War. And your book also talks about some of the drama surrounding the assassination of President Lincoln and the involvement of the Confederate Secret Service headquartered in Montreal, and the fact that one of the conspirators in the assassination who was hung, I think Lewis Powell was his name, is somebody who was very much a part of this, one of Mosby's Rangers. I want to finish, though.
And it's Lewis Powell that captures Richard Blazer.
Yes.
That's what the two main characters, two of my main characters, interact directly
right
with one another and how the story is intertwined.
Right, and that intertwining is a really exciting hallmark of your book. I do want to mention at the very end here that even after General Lee ultimately surrenders at Appomattox, the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, calls for the remaining Confederate soldiers to battle on, engaging in guerrilla warfare. I mean, one last sort of desperate attempt to prolong the Confederacy. To what extent was he successful? That is, Jefferson Davis and this call for the Confederates to fight on even after the surrender.
His decision was a sound one militarily. The South had all of the elements of a incredibly successful guerrilla campaign, and one that would have been incredibly difficult to defeat, that would have taken decades to subdue. It's the Jesse Scouts that interrupt those plans indirectly, because an army marches on its stomach, and it's the Jesse Scouts or Lincoln Special Forces that seize the one thing that General Lee needed more than anything else on his march towards Appomattox, and that was supply, specifically meals. And it's the Jesse Scouts that capture Lee's crucial supply trains. And that has a decisive and crucial element to the war, and it brings it to a conclusion to some degree. But even that, the war still lingers on for months.
It's an extraordinary story, and one that I'm sure was not very easy to tell. I mean, and again, we're talking about contrasting strands of stories from both the North and the South, both in engaging in this so-called irregular fighting. And it is such an important part of this monumentally important part of our own history. The book again is The Unvanquished, The Untold Story of Lincoln's Special Forces, The Manhunt for Mosby's Rangers, and The Shadow War That Forged America's Special Operations. The book includes a number of very, very interesting photographs, and we see some of the faces of some of these people who engaged in this activity. The book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. The author, Patrick K. O'Donnell. Patrick O'Donnell, it was great to speak with you, and I congratulate you on yet another fascinating and compelling book. Thank you for the book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
It was an honor, Greg. Thank you so much for an extraordinary interview.
Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, moving outdoors for its 22nd season, Saturday, May 11th, with over 100 vendors and 130 booths, offering spring produce, cheeses, eggs, flowers, baked goods.